From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
A powerful winter storm is beginning to strike the East Coast. The National Weather Service says the nor'easter will spread ice, snow, and rain from Florida up to Maine.
Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, the longest-serving Republican in the Senate, just announced this afternoon that he will retire at the end of his seventh Senate term and thus will not be on the ballot this November. This sets the stage for Trump nemesis Mitt Romney to potentially run for the seat.
Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei is accusing the country's enemies of causing the largest protest against the Islamic regime in nearly a decade.
President Trump taunting North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un over the size of America's nuclear arsenal.
There were people who come up to me and said, we like what you stand for as far as taking on challenges. Your experience as far as moving Bridgeport forward and your willingness to step up to the plate for Connecticut and for Connecticut cities and people in general. So I've been encouraged by that.
If you'd like to join the conversation about the week's news, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Mark Pazniokas. He's Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Hello, Paz.
Good morning.
And Christine Stewart is here. She's editor-in-chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Good morning, John.
So we just heard the voice of Joe Ganim, who says, well, now he's running. We were joking with Mark Pazniokas over the course of the last week or so, trying to figure out if he was running, if he wasn't running. Now we know for sure he actually is running. I'll give you a first crack at this, Colin, because we're going to go through a couple people who are now saying that they're going to run for governor and maybe a couple other people who were not quite sure yet. What do we think about Joe Ganim getting into this race for real?
Well, let me just back up and say that with the exception of Joe Ganim and Oz Griebel and maybe Ned Lamont, there's other than that, I mean, there's like 40 other people running for governor if you count both sides. And it's like this huge frog pond where there's no apex predator. There's just like a bunch of frogs, you know. There's nothing to take them out. And everybody's strategy except for Joe Ganim and Oz Griebel and maybe Ned Lamont is qualify for CEP, which is the public grant. Go to the convention, get 15%, and then we'll figure something out, right? That's the plan. That's everybody's plan. Now, Joe Ganim, because of some court rulings, cannot qualify for the Citizens Elections Program, which I think has him hitting way, way off the back tees, particularly because he comes in with a very specific kind of baggage, right? So anything that looks like, in terms of conventional non-public funding fundraising, anything he does will be maybe extra scrutinized. I mean, if it's a whole bunch of contractors or whatever, that's not going to be so great.
I don't know why that would be, Colin. Yeah.
So anyway, I don't know. I mean, I think it's like, and I think Pazmet has said this in our emails, it's sort of more of a problem for the party than a realistic possibility. And you kind of wonder what's going on in his head. It just doesn't really seem – I just can't even see him – can you see him getting 15% at the convention?
I'm still puzzled by the suggestion that a convicted extortionist is going to have trouble raising money.
And if he does raise money, like who can he raise it from? Exactly the people that he probably shouldn't raise it from.
Joe's going to be under a spotlight from this – point forward. It's kind of interesting that back in April, when he created his exploratory committee, he really faced very little scrutiny. People sort of said, oh, okay, and they decided they weren't going to deal with it. In a way that when Luke Bronin, the mayor of Hartford, who was elected the same night as Joe Ganim, people said, well, this is outrageous. He's breaking his commitment to Hartford, which all fair criticisms, by the way. But nobody said, well, my God, Joe Ganim is breaking his commitment to Bridgeport so soon after they helped resurrect his career.
He's just broken so many other things.
Well,
it's like Hartford needing to stand out.
But now, you know, I've been talking to party people over the last few days, and they're a little freaked out. It's like, okay, what do we do now? The path to 15%, it won't be easy. But when you start with Bridgeport, it's a lot easier. Bridgeport has the second most number of delegates. He still needs, 240 more that he's going to have to go out to the suburbs or other cities to get. And it's going to be hard in some of the other cities if Luke Bronin is in. And Bronin's already kind of cut deals or made alliances with people in Waterbury, and he's talking to people in New Haven. So there's that. Will he qualify? Where will he get the money? He's going to be under incredible scrutiny for, you know, every campaign finance report based on his past. But the real fear for the Democrats is, should he qualify for a primary? If there is a field that's significantly large, anything can happen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how he gets to – well, I guess there is a path to a Democratic nomination of Joe Ghanem, but I don't see that the party is enthusiastically behind his candidacy. And I think we saw at the first Democratic debate – well, kind of Democratic debate at the Working Families Party shindig in New Haven last month that he is not a favorite of the left.
I would go a little bit further and say, I mean, this is would be a little unusual for the conventions that we've covered in the past, in the sense that he's such a problem. I mean, if this had any traction at all, I mean, trying to imagine Kevin Limbo and Denise Merrill and whoever else running on a ticket with Joe Ghanem at the top. And so I think what you'll see at the convention more than we've typically seen is an organized effort to make sure he doesn't get those extra delegates. Usually conventions are just people kind of lining up behind one candidate or another, and then at some point we'll be out on the floor and John DeStefano will come over and explain some really complicated thing he's worked out. But I mean, here you're going to see an active effort to kill this guy off.
Is there enough attention span for that? I mean, do you think that people, I mean, there's just so many people out there and so many candidates. Can you think about getting your candidate to the, you know, to the 15% while also denying Ghanem the 15%?
Well, and that's where Christine just asked my question really, Pez, is, I mean, the idea that a Democratic Party that has all these, as Colin put them, frogs who really people don't know out there, and we hear, whether it's Politico or anybody else, saying, if any time is a time for a Republican governor to take over Connecticut, now might be the time. I mean, are the Democrats really in a position to be so picky choosy with an unpopular governor currently at the top of their party with who gets the nomination? I mean, if Joe Ghanem gets out there and raises money and Joe Ghanem gets out there and gets a lot of people excited and Joe Ghanem does have more scrutiny than anybody else because of his past, well, we'll have a spotlight on him. I mean, why not Joe Ghanem?
Now is exactly the time for the Democratic Party to be choosy. For everything, for every reason you just said. Yeah, I think Colin's right. I mean, there will be an effort at a convention to sort of keep him short of 15%. And the way they work, I mean, it's not like the old days where there are multiple ballots. Generally, there's one ballot and then there's vote switching to get to an achieved result of either denying people or opening the door to other people, which we've seen both things happen in both parties for various strategic reasons. No, I don't think Mayor Ghanem fully realizes the resistance he's going to face around the state. So because so far it's kind of been a shrug. Well, he's now the mayor of Connecticut's largest city, but he stands convicted of 16 felony counts, including racketeering, extortion, bribery, and conspiracy to do all those things, as well as not paying taxes on about $300,000. And
you with your history lessons, Paz.
I mean, we're getting way ahead of ourselves because, well, we just are. But, I mean, it might be a situation, let's say he was at the convention and was making something of a run. There would be maybe some opportunities for people to make some deals of the kinds that Paz is talking about, you know, post first ballot or something like that. You know, I don't know, New Haven, if there was something else they wanted or something, would be a really good time to have that conversation.
And Joe Ghanem's mentor is Mario Testa, who is the longtime Democratic chairman in Bridgeport. He's an old school kind of deal maker, certainly knows how conventions work. He helped Joe Ghanem win the nomination for lieutenant governor in 1994. By the way, that was not Bill Curry's fault.
No.
I will actually say that. but anyway, so yeah, we are getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. I think for Joe Ghanem, the first test will be the first quarterly finance report. How much money has he been able to raise? Where did he raise it? And is anybody looking at it?
Okay, well, before we move on to the Republicans and an independent Republican running for governor, what about the other names? And we've already talked on the show a lot, Christine, about Luke Bronin getting in without quite finishing out his first term as mayor of Hartford. But what about people who we've seen before in this position, people like Ned Lamont, people like Susan Bisowitz?
Yeah, you know, I think that Ned has made some rumblings about, you know, his interest in the race because there is no front runner, and he would be somebody who would be able to self-fund a campaign, even though I think that voters of Connecticut have summarily dismissed self-funders in general. And I think that Susan Bisewitz, even though she may have PTSD about running for governor, you know, is actually more interested in running for governor than she is state senate in the 13th district.
A self-funder came within 6,400 votes in 2010. So I don't know
true.
That.
Well,
but it's
I mean, it's Linda McMahon, you know, well, as far as the primary goes, Ned Lamont spent.
And Ned's last campaign, you know, for governor, I don't think he got great reviews for how that was waged. Some of the people who worked on that campaign are, I think, less than enthused. But, you know, I think Ned is looking at a wide open field. He's certainly making calls. He's had meetings. He's reached out to potential staff, I'm told. So, you know, we'll see. Susan Bisewitz, Ned, and then we've got others who have been raising money through exploratories for a while.
We just got an email from Sue who says, why isn't Dan Drew getting the attention of the other candidates? The other less qualified candidate, she says, is he getting DNC'd? She also says, Joe Ganim, seriously? So, Colin, Dan Drew, I'll add Dan Drew to
was
the
that
list.
Was Susan Bisewitz who said
no,
that?
Right. No, it was a different Sue.
Okay. That would be counterproductive. Well, let me just say that Ned Lamont and Susan Bisewitz in some ways couldn't be more different in terms of their overall, I don't know, psychological makeup as candidates. I mean, we've covered some Lamont campaigns now. And Ned's a great guy, and I think he's a smart guy, and his heart's in the right place. He's sort of a little dreamy, you know? And that's not a good quality for the most part.
Like in a Ryan Gosling kind of way?
No, not that kind of dreamy, no. Although he's just – there's – you need a laser-like focus to stay in a campaign and win. You cannot take your eye off the ball. That's very much who Susan Bisewitz tends to be. I mean, sometimes she misses certain details, like whether she's actually legally qualified to run for the office she's going for. But in terms of focus, energy, concentration, she's got those things. You can't be lazy or you can't be like more interested in something else. There's things like that that are really – for there are certain candidates who I always look at them and think, I don't know if they can survive – into the thick of this campaign just on a basis of focus. So, and Dan Drew, I don't know. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. It's not just Dan Drew. There's all these Smurfs. It's up to them to kind of break out of the pack somehow. I don't know that Dan Drew has distinguished himself over Jonathan Harris or Sean Connolly, who I just met 2 days ago. Or I don't know. There's like a whole list of them. I don't know why Dan Drew would deserve any particular special focus.
I just want to say, so there was a poll recently as far as, you know, Republican and Democrat, and it's pretty much tied what voters want to see a Democrat or a Republican take the governor's office at this point. So even though you would tend to think that after a Democrat you would see a Republican governor, that might not necessarily be the case. But I think that the Democratic Party is going through some changeover and you know, organizationally at a time that's very inopportune for it to be going through that change.
That was less a poll than a marketing thing for a lobbying firm, you know.
Right, but I mean, I don't think that it's not accurate, you know, based on the
number. There
was
nothing surprising in it.
No, there wasn't.
Connecticut's competitive, and Connecticut's been competitive for a long, long time. And that's the reality. Connecticut is a deep blue state for presidential and congressional elections. But for everything else, not so much, particularly governor. There has not been an easy gubernatorial race for a Democrat in Connecticut since 1986. You know, so Connecticut's in play, clearly, regardless of what any, you know.
Right. Poll. No, I know. But I mean, you know.
I just had to tease you about that because I saw that and was like, what the hell?
So, well, you know, Quinnipiac isn't doing any polling in Connecticut anymore. So we have this dearth of polling. I think that this is something that both parties are struggling right now. They're going to have to spend a large amount of money on polling because there isn't any.
Christine just mentioned some turnover in the Democratic Party. Before we get to the Republican side, Paz, I mean, impact on, say, Denise Napier's potentially not running for her seat as treasurer. Not. So she's not going to run. We already have George Jepson out. I mean, what does this do to the top of the ticket as well if there's all this other churn beneath in the statewide races?
Well, it adds to the potential and the drama at the convention for deal making with all those open seats. you know, the potential for mischief and fun is great. Get your tickets early.
I mean, it also it opens up some opportunities for young, ambitious politicians who, I mean, there's a way in which typically are the upper echelons, both the sort of constitutional officers and U.S. senators and congressional delegations, they tend to calcify. I mean, there's typically not a lot of movement and liquidity up there. So the fact that the AG and treasurer's office would be open is probably a good thing in a way, just to sort of get some interesting new candidates moving through the pipeline.
And Paz, before we take a break, I just want to mention an article you wrote about this sort of push that's coming from the left of the party. And Christina mentioned earlier whether or not Joe Ganim is going to be the type of candidate who people on the left like. Well, increasingly, there's this kind of insurgent push to grade out Democrats based on how well they're going to vote along progressive lines. How big an impact does that have, not necessarily politically coming up in this next election cycle, although perhaps it does, but also on just the way in which Connecticut is being governed right now?
There's a debate going on within the Democratic Party. It's been brewing for a while because of sort of the austerity push on budgeting, where Democrats have become very gun-shy about raising taxes, even on the wealthy. So there's that debate going on. I wrote about a state rep named Josh Elliott, who was the guy who challenged Brendan Sharkey, the sitting speaker, was willing to run a primary against him. Brendan ultimately didn't run for re-election, but Josh was backed by the Working Families Party. And the Working Families Party is trying to pick its shots as well, perhaps backing people in some Democratic primaries who are deemed insufficiently liberal. They would be dying to run somebody against Paul Doyle, one of the state senators who sided with the Republicans in the budget, but Senator Doyle is exploring a run for AG right now. But yeah, there's a lot of energy on the Democratic side in reaction to President Trump. There are a lot of women who are looking to run. All that is to the good for the party, but there tends to be a little bit of chaos in that, you know, some of these women, for example, who are looking to run live in districts where there are now fairly liberal Democrats who hold office. You know, we're seeing that in West Hartford. Andy Fleischman is potentially facing a primary from Jillian Gilchrist, who was one of the organizers of the Women's March in Connecticut. So there's a lot going on there.
Well, I think that the Democratic Party is the Democratic Party. And so you're always going to have these struggles and this unrest within the Democratic Party, from the left and the more moderate and, you know, making sure that all voices are heard in a certain way. So I think we are going to see a lot of challenges to sitting incumbent legislators this year from within their own party.
Colin, last thought on this?
I think it's sort of a precursor also to 2020 at the national level. I mean, there's the way that it's being framed here is maybe less than ideal. I mean, what you really probably want to hear is Democrats saying, all right, well, what do you stand for? Exactly what – I mean, okay, you're a Democrat. What does that mean? Do you subscribe to a lot of things that we might associate, say, with Bernie Sanders? Or are you a little bit more like Democratic Leadership Council kind of, you know, centrist Democrat? And I think that's a fair question. I think primaries are, for the most part, really good for parties. Occasionally they can destroy a good candidate or get an ideologue in there who can't get elected. You saw that at the municipal level on the Republican side in Farmington in the last cycle, where there was a primary and the people who got in there were so red meat they couldn't get elected in the general. But primaries are good. Primaries do make the party examine its own principles. And I think the residue of the Bernie Sanders run in 2016 is a lot of Democrats saying, okay, so what does it mean to you that you're a Democrat? I mean, do you really stand for this bunch of principles, or are you just kind of a placeholder for the party name?
Well, and I think that – and we've said this for years. I mean, Bill Curry's been saying the Democrats need to stand for something for quite some time. A question, though, Colin, is at the state level, maybe is it a little different right now with the state of Connecticut and the state that our budget has been in for quite some time, compared to the ability for Bernie Sanders to be dreamy at the top of the ticket about what a new America might look like, with the idea that many of those things won't be accomplished anytime soon, certainly with a Republican Congress. Anybody pushing from the left at the state level has to grapple with the fact that we have all these gigantic you know, fiscal problems to deal with, and a lot of the solutions that they might bring to the table don't necessarily get at that reality.
I think that's fair. I think that if you look at the national level, when Sanders talks about Medicare for all or universal tuition, college tuition, those sound like great ideas, and he doesn't really exactly have to explain how he's going to pay for them. But the entire conversation in Connecticut, you know, think about all the wheelhouses we've done. So many of the conversations are, how are you even going to pay for basic services, for essentials, the push and pull between needing new revenue sources and not wanting to push people out of the state. It's a much more nitty-gritty conversation, and I think it makes it harder to have the kind of conversation that Elliot is pushing for.
Well, I think that's going to be a problem for all of the candidates. I think it's going to be really hard to rise to the top in this pool because there are so few ideas that you can have that are actually realistic and pragmatic and something you can actually accomplish because there is no surplus.
No, I mean the tension in Connecticut politics right now is the left is reacting and being energized by President Trump, but at the same time there's been this trend where Republicans have been picking up seats every 2 years in the General Assembly to the point where it's pretty much a 50-50 deal. And that's been driven by concerns as to whether or not the Democrats have been good stewards of the Connecticut economy and budget.
I just want to say that sort of cuts both ways, too. So I love Mark Boughton. I think he's a great guy. The last time I knew, he was running on elimination of the state income tax, which is, to me, you're not a serious candidate if you're saying that. For all the reasons we were just saying about the Democrats, if you're going to campaign on elimination of the state income tax, that's not a serious candidacy.
Well, when we come back, let's talk about Mark Boughton getting into the race this week, the Republican mayor of Danbury. Also talk about Oz Griebel getting into the race, and we'll get to some other issues as well. Colin McEnroe is here. He's host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Christine Stewart, Editor-in-Chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Christine Stewart, the editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, Mark Pazniokas, the Capitol Bureau chief of the Connecticut Mirror, ctmirror.org, and also Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Colin, why don't you tell us what's happening on your show today?
Well, a tradition that we started a bunch of years ago was, I like jazz, but I probably don't follow it the way that you do, John. And so at the end of every year, or the beginning of every year, we have a bunch of savants, a bunch of jazz savants, including Gene Seymour, a jazz critic, and Noah Behrman, your friend, a pianist. We'll all be in studio today. Also, we are introducing a new surprise panelist on the show today. We're going to review the jazz releases, best jazz releases from 2017.
I will be listening in. That's a lot of fun today on the Colin McEnroe Show at 1 o'clock. So we talked a lot about some of the shifting sands on the Democratic side in the race for governor. On the Republican side, so we've got Mark Boughton officially saying now he's going to run. We've been hearing Paz about Mark Boughton running for this office, not just this time, but in the past. He's the popular mayor of Danbury. He's an interesting guy, very good on social media, and he's going to give it another swing.
Yes, he's been exploring this time since November of 2016.
That's a while ago.
It's a while ago. Now, he did have a very eventful 2016. He had brain surgery. It was a success, but that certainly... that was a setback. It was a hell of a setback, let's be honest.
Yeah.
This is Mark's third time around. Mayors generally have some crossover appeal. They tend to be pragmatic. Not all of them, but many of them. But he was never able to really get traction in the previous two times. He ended up as Tom Foley's running mate the first time in 2010. He didn't get very far in 2014. So we'll see if this is his moment. It's the Republican field is much bigger than the Democrats at this point. There's something like 14 of them, and at least I think nine of them, I think, have shown significant fundraising ability.
Well, yeah, there's fundraising ability, Christine, but there's also some name recognition. The fact that Mark Boughton has been on a ticket before, the fact that he's been in Connecticut politics for quite some time, maybe that means a little bit more something than just the ability to raise money right now, because people need to know who you are.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. And, you know, he is aware of the, you know, having done this, the delegates don't change all that often. So he's aware of the Republican Party and who he needs and how he needs to get to that, you know, get to the nomination if he's going to get there. I think that it would be a struggle. It's going to be a struggle for him to get there. I mean, there's just so many candidates at this point. It's so up in the air.
And Colin, as you were saying before the break, you know, if he's saying we're going to get rid of the income tax, that doesn't seem like a proposal that's going to make a whole lot of sense right now. I mean, what can a Republican gubernatorial candidate do to set him or herself apart from the field at a time in which, you know, you're running against all these other Democrats and you're trying to say, you know, I'm the anti-Malloy. I'm going to do something that's good for the state budget.
Yeah, but both sides are a little short on ideas right now. There's reasons for that. I mean, the fundraising lift is so big to qualify for the state grants that they tend to focus on that a little bit more and maybe are not shopping ideas around. And maybe, by the way, I'm not being fair to Mark. Maybe I really should just look at his proposal and see whether he's actually able to do this state income tax thing in a way that makes sense. But I just want to say one thing about mayors, too, which is the mayors until 2006, I think it was 2006 when we had DeStefano and Malloy contending, vying for the state gubernatorial nomination. Typically, mayors don't run that well because they're really famous in their own cities. And they were surrounded by people going, wow, Mr. Mayor, if your ideas would just get out, you know, everybody in the state would love you. And that's not necessarily true. So but Mark, you're OK. Mark is sort of in a different position now because he's been seen by a lot of other people, you know, in a lot of other contexts too, because all these, you know, previous runs have helped boost his visibility up a little bit. And also, he's very smart about things like social media, you know. I mean, this is a guy who really likes Twitter, you know, and does interesting things with Twitter. So he may be able to help himself that way too.
No, you're right. Mayors historically have not done very well, except this time there are no members of Congress running.
Right.
There's nobody who's held statewide office running. On the Republican side, you do have at least three I can think of off the top of my mind who have been on a statewide ticket. Mark Boughton, Peter LaMage last year, who was a candidate for Secretary of State, and Tim Herbst, who was the Republican nominee for state treasurer. So you're right. There's been nothing special about, you know, mayors until Dan Malloy was elected in 2010. But there's none of the usual suspects
right.
or places. So
and never say never. I mean,
yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if in 2020, if the fields are weak on either side, you could see a guy like Mitch Landrieu running for president. If you had kind of a crowded field or something. I mean, you can do it with a certain kind of personality, a certain kind of profile. And I think Mark has kind of moved beyond being just the mayor of Danbury. I don't know what else he is, the Thane of Cawdor maybe. But I think people think of him as more than that at this point.
Well, I think he does have a large presence on social media, and I think that that helps. You know, he responds to people. It's not just that, you know, he tweets out a bunch of stuff and is there and responsive. He responds back if you tweet at him.
So then there's the Republican who's going to run as an independent, Oz Griebel, who's actually already picked a running mate. And I don't know, I'll ask you first, Paz, but I'd love everyone's thoughts about this. I mean, Oz is somebody else who's gotten a little bit of statewide recognition. He's known outside of just the city of Hartford as a leader in the greater Hartford region. And he's doing something in running for governor as an independent that has a couple, at least Republicans, maybe a little nervous.
Well, Tim Herbst's campaign has taken two shots at him. One direct, saying a vote for Oz Griebel is a vote for the Democrat. And then more recently, Tim Herbst has challenged all the other Republicans to take a pledge that they back the eventual nominee, whomever that may be. I think Oz Griebel is one of the people in Connecticut who is quietly rooting for Joe Ganim to become the Democratic nominee for governor. and hope that there's perhaps a hard right candidate who's nominated by the Republicans. And
or Roland, and, you know. He's yeah. out.
He is out. He's out. But I don't think
that's Oz's path to victory.
I don't think Governor Roland is free of his encumbrances, so I don't think he's legally able to run, to be technical about it. Although, who knows?
Who knows?
You know, that'd be a great fusion ticket, Ganim Roland.
Well, I don't know, but you know, Tim Herbst is worried about it. Should other Republicans be worried about Oz Griebel getting in as an independent?
Well, I think it's an interesting decision to go for it as an independent and to pick a running mate who is a Democrat. You know, so in a state where more of the voters are unaffiliated than they are either Democrats or Republicans, so we have these two separate systems set up, and I think that. There's an opportunity. It's harder to use the citizens' election program if you are not affiliated with a party, and there's a reason why. But
yes, the legislature made sure of that. Yeah.
The legislature made sure of that.
And he's not anyway. He said
right.
He's,
yeah. I know, but I think that there is there might be a path to victory, and I think that there is some real excitement. And I think if you go around the state. And you talk to business people or people associated with the chambers, they're well-versed in Oz Griebel, and they like him a lot.
Yeah, I think that that's actually an important point, Colin, is that because he's part of this sort of regional system, the folks who run Fairfield County actually know a little bit and have interacted with an Oz Griebel in the way they might not have mayors of some mid-sized cities.
And that's going to have to be the case because he's raising his money outside the state grant process. So he's going to have to know some business people who are going to have to be willing to give him some money for this run. I don't know. I always feel like if I personally like somebody who's running for governor, that should be a danger sign for them because it probably means they're a halfway normal person as opposed to some frothing at the mouth maniac. And maniacs with like hyper focused maniacs, as I said in the previous segment, do better. You need a lot of focus. You need to really want to do this, and you need to go to every freaking beanhole supper in like some. And Oz is like I don't know Oz that well, but I do know him kind of as a person. I don't feel like he's that person. I think he's a normal, well-balanced person who I just wonder, again, whether he has the kind of single focus that you need to do this. I would also point out, as far as I know, Oz is still a bachelor, which we haven't had a bachelor governor in quite a while. So
there are several running. Oz is not going to have his fate in his own hands. And what I mean by that is I think the success of his candidacy is going to be a reaction to what the other parties do or don't do. He's going to need to – with ideas because he's going to have to draw attention by coming out with some very clear-cut positions, not waffle, and establish himself as kind of a non-political guy this year while the Democrats and the Republicans go left and right. You know, on the Republican side right now, you know, Tim Herbst, who the former first electman of Trumbull, you know, he's running hard right. He's saying if I'm elected governor, I'm going to push for the reinstatement of capital punishment, for example.
And not necessarily for people who have committed crimes. He thinks that's too restrictive.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Colin McEnroe.
Or he'll let his mom do it for him. I think that Oz will be putting forward some public policy measures that are, you know, realistic. And I think instead of waiting for the Republicans and the Democrats to react, that he could actually begin setting the tone for the gubernatorial campaign.
But, you know, he's doing something nobody really has done. I mean, Lowell Weicker and Joe Lieberman were outliers. I mean, they were elected as independents with 100% name recognition among anybody who was likely to vote. And Oz doesn't have that. So, I think it's possible there's a path for him, but it's let's be honest, it's a very difficult one, and he's got to catch a lot of breaks.
But I got to say, if there's a name in the entire field that you might remember, I don't know.
No,
Oz
absolutely.
Is a pretty good one. Let's turn to something else. I know, Christine, you wanted to talk about this. Turn away from some state politics and look at a few facets of the impact of the Trump tax plan, the Republican tax plan in Washington. We've talked a little bit about this. Obviously, so many details in this not necessarily good for people in states like Connecticut, New York, California. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But one of the things that came out in Donald Trump's victory speech surrounding the GOP tax bill is he basically declared Obamacare dead. This effectively kills it. But the numbers don't necessarily back this up. Obamacare is still kind of grooving along here.
It's more than grooving along. I mean, look, the advertising budget for the ACA was cut from $100 million down to $10 million. And enrollment this year in the 38 exchanges that are run by the federal government was 8.74 million, which, you know, last year it was 9.2 million. So what, we lost about 400,000 people for one reason or another. So I think that enrollment has been resilient. I think the ACA has been resilient and has avoided, you know, the repeal efforts. And I don't think eliminating the individual mandate will kill it, because it's not necessarily the heart of the program. The heart of the program is the tax subsidies, the guaranteed issue for pre-existing conditions, and expansion of Medicaid.
Is there any chance this upcoming session, Paz, that Connecticut lawmakers look to do something different around health care in Connecticut, given what may be happening over time to Obamacare at the federal level?
As we've discussed earlier, money is a limiting factor on what they can do on a lot of things. But yeah, they had a debate last session about how to protect people from the potential losses of the Affordable Care Act. But it's, as Christine said, you know, it's hanging in there. I mean, if nothing else, that whole debate showed there's a demand for this. There's a significant demand for this. And that's been the Republicans' biggest problem in trying to repeal it. They haven't figured out what to replace it with, but yet they acknowledge there's a demand, as well as, again, the Medicaid expansion that many states accepted, Connecticut included. And if you take that away, you know, there's going to be a revolution in this country.
I think that Connecticut could actually go forward with its own individual mandate. I think you might see some debate on that. You know, Massachusetts still has its mandate in place to purchase insurance. I think Connecticut could also do that. And look, we have, you know, Orrin Hatch, you know, retiring, and Mitt Romney, who was, you know, the grandfather of this plan within Massachusetts, you know, in the wings, you know, possibly running for that seat. So I think there could be some changes.
So the mandate can be a little bit confusing, and I haven't seen a really great analysis of this yet, but I mean, it was clear that because premiums ran high for some people in like the self-employment area of Obamacare, they were willing to pay the penalty. I mean, there were people who were willing to pay a tax penalty and go without the health insurance because they didn't want to pay those premiums. So that's an argument for saying that the elimination of the penalty won't kill Obamacare or may not hurt it as bad as we think. Well, I have this resolution, New Year's resolution, which I haven't carried out yet, which is to go back and read the Supreme Court decision on Obamacare, because as I recall, it hinged a little bit on the penalty and on what kind of program. I think the Roberts decision has something, and I was sort of wondering whether the Republicans are trying to get rid of the penalty because they could retry it in the courts and maybe win it that way.
So the decision upheld the individual mandate.
Right. And, yeah. And I think they upheld it because it was a tax, right? I don't know. I want to go back and read that. I just want to say I agree with that.
You're right. Yeah. I mean, it was over the power to tax. I mean, yeah. That became pivotal in that.
Right. So I'm just sort of wondering about whether that's part of their strategy. But back to Connecticut, I do think that a smart thing to talk about anyway, at a time when every conversation that we have that involves raising taxes to create more revenues, more people are going to leave, is if you create a place where your tax revenue buys you some things that you want and for which there is a perceived and real need, like healthcare, you're doing something smart. So if it's done in a smart way, in a, you know, something close to a revenue neutral way, I don't know how you do that, but it would be a great idea for Connecticut to start offering things you can't get in Florida.
I just want to move to another potential outcome of this tax bill, Paz. You know, a lot of states, including now Connecticut's head of revenue services, sort of wondering, okay, if Connecticut is going to be the brunt of this new Republican tax bill, make it impossible for people to deduct quite as much on their state taxes, are we going to join some other states and figure out a way to skirt around that? I know Kevin Sullivan's at least talking about that.
Yeah, they'll talk about it. But I'll confess, I am not that well versed on the legal possibilities of doing that. How you could make that happen? And it's something that's crucial in Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, California, and oddly all the blue states. But you know, it has impacts for a whole bunch of nonprofits. You know, because part of that bill was to nudge people away from itemizing and taking standard deductions. And there's been a lot of data that charities do poorly in that. You know, the fewer people who itemize, the fewer people who tend to give to things like WNPR and the Connecticut Mirror and the United Way and everything else.
Yeah.
So I think that what they're going to find if they try to – so the idea is to try to get the employers to pay this payroll tax so that the employees are not on the hook for it within their individual taxes. And I think what they're going to find out is that the economy has changed. So I think that the state of Connecticut and maybe the other states haven't looked at the tax structure and how the tax structure should be structured in order to maximize revenue in this new economy. I mean, I know a ton of people who don't have one job and get one W-2 and pay one, you know.
The idea of taxing the payroll back in 1955 would make a whole lot of sense.
Yes.
Right now, there's a lot of people in this gig economy, people yes. who aren't necessarily getting paid that way. And so we are already facing all sorts of revenue shortfalls. Talk about really facing revenue shortfalls that way.
Right. And so if you discover that – so we're facing revenue shortfalls because there is no – there's not a lot of predictability here. So we have the estimated and final payments that are actually going to be on the income tax, which are actually – which self-employed people pay, which are actually going to be higher when they come with the revenue estimates in January because people wanted to be able to deduct them in 2017. So we're going to have this one-time revenue hit, and it's gonna screw up, you know, the mentality over budgeting.
It's hard to talk intelligently about this because they did it so fast and they did it at the end of the year. And yeah, as Christine is saying, you've got people running around. Danny Hart has a pretty funny column about like calling his mortgage company and calling his local tax office and just trying to figure out what he could possibly do in those days that are trickling by before January 1st. Back to the other point about withholdings. So people who get so-called 1099 income, that's the gig economy people, right? The people who are essentially self-employed, they're already completely screwed. I mean, they've been historically screwed by what's called the self-employment tax, which is if you're on a W-2, your employer is paying half of your FICA and half of your OASDI, which is how entitlements are funded. If you're a 1099 employee, you pay the full freight on that. You pay 100% of it. So to create another advantage for the W-2 class of employee would be punitive towards the 1099 economy. I think ultimately that's so unappetizing. I await a creative solution to the problem that's been created by Congress for blue states with high tax structures. I don't think the one that's being talked about in Connecticut right now is that solution.
We've got to take a break. When we come back, you know what? If we don't have any money in the state, let's play the lottery. We can win the lottery. Well, maybe we can't win the lottery. We're going to talk about that when we come back a little bit and clean up some other things from the week's news with Colin McEnroe, with Christine Stewart, with Mark Pazniokas here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. Before we get to a snafu at the lottery, I just want to talk quickly about where we are as far as the state budget deficit. We love to talk about the fact that we're back in a state budget deficit. And what exactly do we do about this, Paz and Christine? I'll start with you, Paz. I mean, how are lawmakers handling this?
Why, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to increase spending by $54 million,
of course. That makes perfect sense.
It does. They say they will offset it. So they're going to come back. They were supposed to come back tomorrow, but the storm may have something to do with that.
The snow bomb. So let's just be clear.
Yes. Either Storm Grayson, if you follow the Weather Channel, or I think Storm Brody, if you're a fan of Channel 3.
Winter storms are not named.
That's right. Let's listen to Christine on this. Winter storms are not named. But anyway, yes. So they're not going to come back tomorrow because of this snow bomb.
Grayson. So the first order of business is to restore funding for a Medicare savings program, which was made more generous in 2010. The Malloy administration has said it's actually rational to roll it back a little bit. But, you know, they got great outcry from elderly folks who are struggling with their copays and other things on Medicare. So they're going to restore that. They have not divulged how they're going to offset that spending increase. And nor have they come close to discussing how they're going to approach the larger problem of $225 million deficit projected for the current fiscal year. The governor has put forth a menu of options. Many of them are things that no legislator seeking reelection is really eager to do in election year, and that's where we are.
Yeah. Of the $300 million the governor put forward as the menu of options, about $189 million of it is tax increases. So there's nothing desirable in there for them. And they want to wait until they see these January 16th revenue estimates because, you know, look— us in the gig economy may have made some estimated tax payments that might be a lot higher than they originally estimated. And, you know, those Christmas sales might have been better. So, you know, they're going to wait.
I think the really fun part of this is they knew that Governor Malloy wasn't running for reelection. They knew that they were going to have to deal with this now in their election year. And they probably knew that he was going to end up sticking with a bunch of things that they didn't want to have to do. But yet, that's somehow where we ended up anyway.
They didn't do it at the end of June. I mean, at the end of June, they didn't pass a budget. They should have ripped off the Band-Aid, and they didn't.
And we know what they're going to do. They're going to do what they did in 2009, the last budget that Jody Rell did in concert with the Democratic legislature. They borrowed. Not only did they borrow 10 years ago— they borrowed money to make the first payments on that borrowing. You know, one of the reasons why Connecticut is in the great shape it's in right now is because of stuff like that. And they're going to borrow again. How much? I don't know. But that's certainly going to be one of the approaches.
Colin?
I mean, the history of these kinds of budgets over the last few years is that they're constantly flopping back into default, right? Basically, they balance for a month or two, and then there's a new revenue estimate, or there's a different problem, or they didn't resolve the whole hospital tax question effectively. Or, I mean, I think this thing is going to, this budget will just stumble through the year with a series of problems of this kind.
I want to turn to you for the last little point here, Colin. We were reading our friend John Lender's piece in the Hartford Current. I'll read from the top of it. The Connecticut Lottery Corporation spent Tuesday trying to come up with explanations concerning a human error that shut down 100,000 eligible tickets out of Monday's 11 a.m. drawing in the New Year's $1 million super draw game. It's now forced a second drawing on the date to be announced. By late afternoon, lottery officials posted answers to a list of frequently asked questions on their site, including the fact that people who won in Monday's flawed drawing can win for a second time in the special drawing. This is more than a little bit of a snafu. This is kind of, I don't know, it's funny, but it's not that funny.
No, it's funny. My favorite part of John's article was that whole thing that it was one of the answers to frequently asked questions. You'd have to hope that that wouldn't be a frequently asked question. Why are we playing this game twice? And it's even being suggested that they might have to do it a third time. So basically what happened was they forgot how many people were playing the game, essentially. They miscalculated how many people were playing the game, so some people didn't get drawn. So the one theory would be that you would then – and, of course, the other thing that happens is some people, when they are told they didn't win, they rip up their tickets, you know, and they don't have their tickets anymore. So it really – it's a public relations disaster. The one – you know, it's kind of like that you had one job. This isn't a really complicated thing, all right? It just isn't that complicated. You know, everybody buys a ticket, you get everybody's tickets together, and then you pull one of them.
You forgot to put them all in the hat. What?
So, I don't know.
You pass. Did you have a thought on this?
No. Other than there's another state I'm blanking on. Is it South Carolina where the problem was the opposite, that all the tickets turned out to be winners, and that was a mistake, and now they got to redo that.
That would be a bigger mistake.
Yes.
That's the sort of mistake we don't want to have. Okay, I'm going to spring this on you guys. We just have about a minute or so left in the show. You ready for this? Quick New Year's resolution. Go. Christine.
More partnerships.
More partnerships.
Yeah.
I like that. More partnerships.
More partnerships.
Just in business.
Just in general, more partnerships, more friendships, you know, in business partnerships and life friendships.
I like that. That's a good resolution. I was – now, you've started us off so well. I'm wondering if Paz is going to still be able to be snarky, if he's going to give us a legitimate, really nice New Year's resolution. Go quick, Paz.
To make sure there's no drama at my daughter's wedding.
Oh,
that's a good resolution.
That's
people.
A very good resolution, yes. And congratulations on that. That'll be a good thing this year. Colin, how about you?
I'm stealing mine from Nate Silver, which is to stop following shiny objects in the news. Like, you know, if Trump tweets about, oh, I've got a bigger button than Kim Jong-un or, you know, whatever, that's not really a story. That's just him being a jerk. So let's figure out what the real story is that he doesn't want us to follow.
And you'll notice, we didn't really talk about that this week on The Wheelhouse. I think that that's a good resolution. Let's just talk about the things that really matter. With Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, something that matters today in his show. He's talking about the best jazz of 2017. You should listen in. Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, ctmirror.org, and Christine Stewart, Editor-in-Chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. Thanks to our technical producer, Kion Wolf, our executive producer, Katie Talarski, and thanks to all of you for listening this year and in this upcoming year to The Wheelhouse here on WNPR.